Oyez, oyez, oyez. All persons having business before the Honorable, the United States Court of Appeals for the District of Columbia Circuit are admonished to draw near and give their attention, for the court is now sitting. God save the United States and its Honorable Court. Be seated, please. Case number 08-5524, Thomas G. Davis et al., Appellant versus Pension Benefit Guarantee Corporation. Mr. Shelley for the appellant, Mr. Ambruster for the appellee.
Good morning. Good morning, and may it please the court. I'm Anthony Shelley, here on behalf of the appellants, a group of retired and retirement-eligible U.S. Airways pilots. We appeal here the district court's denial of a preliminary injunction to prevent what is known as recoupment pending completion of the district court litigation. Whereas the Pension Benefit Guarantee Corporation, the PBGC, sought to take back benefits already paid, only to then have to give them right back to the pilots in the event the pilots succeed in their litigation, the pilots requested that the status quo be maintained and everyone simply keep the financial positions therein until completion of the underlying litigation. A panel of this court already granted an injunction halting recoupment pending appeal. In turn, the PBGC has said in its briefing that the issues are exactly the same for granting the injunction pending appeal as for determining the propriety of the denial of the preliminary injunction. At page 10 of their reply, for instance, they say, as Holiday Tours teaches, exactly the same four-factor test applies both to a motion for stay pending appeal and the underlying appeal of the denial of the preliminary injunction. Nothing would be gained by having the parties in this court address the same issues twice. So under the PBGC's logic, with the issues being the same, the earlier panel's grant of the injunction pending appeal should lead to a reversal of the denial of the preliminary injunction.
We shouldn't even be having oral argument.
Well, what the
you think it's already resolved, right?
Well, I think that the scale is tipped in our favor. The thumb is on our side because the panel has already looked at the issues. The issues are the same and given us the relief we've sought. Obviously, the panel thinks further elucidation of the issues was useful, and so we're here. But we think there's essentially a presumption that we should succeed in our appeal as a result of the first panel's decision. In the time I have, I'd like to focus on the one preliminary injunction factor that the district court held was not in our favor, the likelihood of success on the merits.
I just ask you preliminarily about irreparable harm because ordinarily, where it's a question of money, as you described it in your opening, I think correctly, ordinarily that's not a basis for finding irreparable harm under our cases, at least.
Typically, money is not the finding of the basis of irreparable harm. When the party can be made whole at the end of the day,
right,
with a return of the money, interest, those sorts of things. That's not the case here. And one case before this court earlier, Friends of All Children from the, I believe it was 1984, the court in fact indicated that really there shouldn't be what the court I think used a slavish adherence to this idea of money not being applicable for irreparable harm. Because if the party can't be made whole at the end, it is irreparable harm. They can't be put in the position they otherwise would have been in. And here the district court made two findings that lead to irreparable harm. One involved IRAs. The other involved the age and unique sort of character of this group and the unlikelihood of their getting back the money in at the end of the day. So while money, it's an unusual case where money leads to irreparable harm. This is that unusual case. And really, the district court's finding on that can't be overturned unless it's really clearly erroneous. On the likelihood of success on the merits factor, on counts one and two, our complaint is a complicated one. It's 192 pages. There are 50 pages, essentially, of substantive allegations. It raises 11 claims. We focused on three specific claims, claims 1, 2, and 10, to show that we were likely to succeed. On counts one and two, the district court focused, it really steeped its analysis in Chevron deference and said that because of deference, the PBGC was likely to win those claims, but also said that, particularly on claim one, for instance, that absent deference, the PBGC's position was less than convincing. Our view that absent Chevron deference, the district court's holdings are insupportable and we have the likelihood of success on the merits. On claims one and two. On both of those claims one and two, the PBGC is acting as a trustee in the distribution of a terminated plan's assets. The statute, ERISA, ascribes the task of distributing assets to the trustee, not to the corporation. And the statute's written quite carefully in giving the corporation, the PBGC, certain tasks and giving on the other hand, plan administrators or trustees certain tasks. The task of distributing plan assets is given to a plan administrator or trustee here. And it would be a task that a private party would do as a trustee if the PBGC had not sought to do it as a trustee and sought the appointment as a trustee. And the PBGC would be doing it had a court not given the PBGC the trustee role. So the question really on the deference is whether the PBGC acting as a trustee is permitted Chevron deference. The answer is no. It is not entitled to Chevron deference as a trustee. The district court...
Why not?
For several reasons. First of all, if this were a private trust,
if it were, obviously not, but it's not. It's a governmental agency, so I don't understand why the capacity in which it's acting necessarily makes a difference.
Well, there are a couple cases that have already described kind of the difference in the capacity between the government acting as the government and the government acting as a trustee. We provided several of those cases through 28J letters, for instance. The cases involving Native Americans, this court's quite clearly stated that the government's acting as a trustee, and therefore it can't hide behind administrative discretion. There's a case from Judge Easterbrook that we cited to the court, UAL Corp, where the court says the roles of the PBGC are different. It's either when it's appointed as a trustee, it's just like a private party. A private party would have no discretion, would get no deference interpreting ERISA. And therefore, the PBGC as a trustee should not either. And the Fourth Circuit, in a case, Wilmington Shipping, said that it really stands the statute on end, really, to give the PBGC more rights as a trustee than a private party would have, because Congress specifically said either a private party or the PBGC could fill the role as a trustee. And it would be disadvantageous to the very parties that ERISA is seeking to protect, the employees, the retirees themselves, to give the PBGC more discretion and more deference than a private trustee would have. And you'd have fights all the time. You can see this coming, in fact, that if the PBGC gets the deference, there's going to be a fight on the appointment of the PBGC as the trustee in every case where a plan is terminated. So in addition to that, this particular case, the PBGC as a trustee shouldn't get deference. It's not the particular issues, for instance, on claim one, the definition of what in effect means under the statute, that's not one the PBGC has answered in this particular context in a regulation or in formal adjudication, and that's not the type of decision that typically is afforded deference in the current Chevron terminology.
But I thought under claim one, the PBGC was actually interpreting a regulation which describes the benefits in priority category three. So they are interpreting their regulation, aren't they?
They begin with the statute. They begin with the statute, which the regulation is interpreting. The statute uses the word when a plan amendment is in effect. You have to take the plan, go back 5 years, and determining what was in effect during the five years ago. But the regulation simply repeats that. The regulation that actually is most at issue is the one that says a plan amendment is in effect on the day of its adoption or the day it became effective. So the PBGC...
Okay. Well, what about this language limited to the lowest annuity benefit payable under the plan provisions?
I think that particularly relates to if you have an election option under a plan, you can't take the election that would give you the greatest benefit. You have to take the one that would give you the lowest benefit. So here, that really is not an issue. The plan amendment was in effect for 5 years. If it had various elections, well, then the lowest election would have to be chosen to produce the lowest benefit. But that doesn't mean you go back 5 years and then look throughout the 5 years and pick, well, when is the benefit the lowest, and let's give them the lowest benefit. The focus in the statute, as well as the regulation, is what was the plan provision in effect for that whole 5 years. And there's no dispute that for 5 years, the plan provision was exactly the same. I'd like to just mention on the deference point, the court's earlier Boivin decision. The PBGC has rested on that. Boivin didn't purport to answer this issue of whether Chevron deference applies in a situation where the PBGC would be acting as a trustee. And in the end, Boivin spoke of compelling exhaustion in order to create a record and be able to give the type of deference the plan would usually get in a typical ERISA case. In fact, in Boivin, the court cited this court's earlier decision in Communication Workers versus AT&T, which is a typical ERISA case, not the PBGC acting as a trustee, but a private party, an employer, acting as a trustee. And the court specifically said there we need to have a record because the plan administrator needs to interpret the plan terms and needs to interpret the facts, not interpret ERISA. An ERISA plan administrator would not be given deference in a typical situation to interpret ERISA itself. And so we think that decision actually supports us because the court was seeking a record in order to elucidate plan interpretation issues, which aren't really an issue here.
I was looking to see if you would address this case from 2000, and I didn't see it, the Independent Petroleum Association versus DeWitt, in which our court held that self-interest alone was not enough to give rise to any automatic rebuttal of deference, and unless Congress has shown a special intent to withhold deference, that the fact that the agency might have a self-interest when it's interpreting something is not an automatic loss of deference.
Yeah, we hadn't addressed that, and we don't say that the self-interest alone does away with Chevron deference. We make an analogy instead to ERISA case law where a trustee, in fact, would in fact be given somewhat lesser deference because of the financial interest they might have.
Okay, all right. So you're saying it's because if they were private, they wouldn't have deference, as opposed to the fact that they do have a self-interest as trustee rather than guarantor means no deference. Is that what you're saying?
That's what we're saying. We're not saying the government would get no deference if it has a self-interest, although there are cases, there's a lot of water that's gone on under the Chevron bridge since the year 2000. And obviously the Supreme Court in the Meade case, for instance, and cases since then has become more skeptical of giving deference to agencies. The Supreme Court's never addressed whether self-interest would lower the amount of deference, but the one other point I'd like to make is we're not dealing here with a typical agency. We're dealing here with a government corporation that has its own budget and collects money from private parties, employers, to run itself. And in that sense,
that's true of a lot of government agencies, though not the the precise facts here, maybe, but a lot of government agencies would be interested in adopting a regulation that helps the government collect money, for example. So I'm not sure that can distinguish it from interpretation of a forfeiture statute
or IRS or
right,
something.
IRS.
And again, we don't rely heavily on the idea that self-interest alone does away with deference. It's a combination of various of all the different factors that leads to no deference here, particularly the trustee role. And I'd like to reserve any other time I have for rebuttal.
All right. Thank you. Mr. Armbruster.
May it please the Court, James Armbruster for Pension Benefit Guarantee Corporation. The District Court denied the preliminary injunction here. It found no likelihood of success on the merits. We believe that the District Court was clearly correct about that, as I'll explain in a few minutes. But I'd like to start out first addressing irreparable harm briefly.
Well, can I start even before that with the injunction pending appeal that Mr. Shelley mentioned?
Yes.
Because you had argued that the standard for the injunction pending appeal is the same as the standard for the appeal of the denied preliminary injunction.
Yes, Your Honor. But
if you're right about that, and a prior panel granted the injunction pending appeal, resolves the appeal of the denied preliminary injunction as well.
I don't think that's the case here, Your Honor. There's a procedure for, it's sort of a two-step procedure. There's a stay pending appeal, and then which is just pending the appeal, and then there's the preliminary injunction pending the whole case. I think it's similar to what
you said. Exactly the same four-factor test applies both to a motion for stay pending appeal and the underlying appeal of the denial of the preliminary injunction.
It is the same four-factor test, but I don't think that precludes this court, this panel, from taking a harder look. I think it's understood that a stay pending appeal is sort of a preliminary, more cursory look at the issue.
It's not supposed to be. I mean, maybe that's an issue for us, but
I think it would be ironic, Your Honor, motions panel referred it to this panel. I think if they had felt that they had addressed it as we wish they had, I think it should have been combined together as one thing, but that's not what the motions panel chose to do.
Okay, maybe that's an issue for our rules.
Turning to the irreparable harm, as Judge Kavanaugh's question suggested, this court does not even need to reach the merits issues here if you find that there's no irreparable harm. It's important to remember that the question is not whether there's some hardship. There's no doubt that having money taken away, having your pension benefits reduced, can cause some hardship. We acknowledge that. But the question here is whether there's irreparable harm in the legal sense. And many, many cases from this court and other courts have all held that normally harm is not irreparable if it can be remedied by the payment of money at a later time. And there's no question here that if the pilots ultimately prevail in this litigation, PBGC will make back payments of any money that they are found owing with interest. That's set forth in our regulations, and the pilots have not disputed that. So I think that the pilots' case fails on that very threshold requirement of irreparability. They try to get around it in two ways. First, they assert, well, the plaintiffs here are all elderly, but if that were the rule, then that could be said in any case. None of us knows whether we'll be here tomorrow to collect money that might later be owing. And in fact, this court in the Boivin case 3 years ago actually rejected that very argument. It said, surely the mere fact that they are retirees does not constitute irreparable harm. And I would also point out that they were relatively young retirees, all 70 or younger. Secondly, they assert that the money that they received in lump sums from U.S. Airways necessarily is in their IRAs and that they'll lose the tax advantages of having the money sheltered in IRAs. But interestingly, not a single pilot actually stepped forward to say this would necessarily, definitely happen. And under this court's cases, allegations have to be more than just conclusory of that sort. They have to actually assert imminent great harm. So in sum, I think you could decide this case purely on the irreparable harms ground. But turning to likelihood of success on the merits, the pilots strenuously dispute the district court's holding that PBGC's interpretations of ERISA are entitled to deference. And it's understandable that they do so because I think they know that they lose this case if the court grants deference, because our interpretations, I believe, are so clearly permissible under the Chevron analysis. But this court and the Supreme Court has repeatedly given Chevron deference to PBGC in the LTV case, in Mead Corp versus Tilley, and in the Beck case, a unanimous decision from just 2 years ago. All of those cases granted Chevron deference to PBGC. Indeed, Mead Corp versus Tilley involved the very same provision at issue here, 29 U.S.C. section 1344A. That was the provision there. The court said Chevron deference to PBGC. And on the self-interest point that Mr. Shelley raised, in the LTV case, we had a huge self-interest. We were talking about a $2 billion claim that was either on or off PBGC's books, depending on how that case turned out. And that didn't deter the Supreme Court from granting deference to PBGC. This court, too, as Mr. Shelley acknowledged in the Boivin case, granted deference, he challenged whether the court actually held that. Interestingly, the pilots, by their former counsel, actually conceded that deference applies in the Boivin case, and the court seemed to accept that concession and didn't have any trouble with it. Moreover, as Judge Brown's question suggested, this case largely turns on interpretation of PBGC's own regulations. The Supreme Court in Auer versus Robbins and a recent unanimous case in Kennedy has said that an agency's interpretation of its own regulations is controlling unless plainly erroneous or inconsistent with the regulation. PBGC's interpretations of its regulations easily pass that test. Now, the pilots try to cloud the issue by asserting, well, PBGC was acting in a trustee role here, and somehow that's different. We think that's essentially a red herring. There's no question that what is at issue here is interpretation of the statute and interpretation of the regulations. It doesn't matter whether we are acting as trustee or guarantor. We are interpreting the statute. PBGC administers this federal insurance program, and our interpretations are entitled to deference. Turning to the specific claims, claim one involves whether certain enhanced early retirement benefits are entitled to priority in what's known as priority category three, or PC3 for short. And the statute says that a benefit is in PC3 if it was in pay status or could have been in pay status at least 3 years before the termination date, but limited to the benefit based on the plan provisions in effect during the five-year period under which the benefit would be the least. Now, PBGC has definitively construed that provision in its regulations. As Judge Brown suggested, and I think this is key to this claim, section 4044.13b3 of our regulation makes very clear that we look to the lowest annuity benefit payable under the plan provisions at any time during the five-year period ending on the termination date. Now, there's absolutely no dispute that the five-year period, first of all, is April 1998 through March of 2003. There's no dispute that no pilot could receive and no pilot did receive these enhanced benefits in April 1998, the first month of the five-year period. The earliest that any pilot could receive it was May 1st, 1998, which was 4 years and 11 months before the termination date. Therefore, PBGC very reasonably determined, just interpreting its own regulation, which I think was fairly clear already, that that the lowest benefit payable under the plan provisions was the benefit without that enhancement. The PBGC's appeals board explained this in considerable detail. I would encourage your honors to take a look at that decision. It's a model of reasoned decision making by an agency. It took the pilot's claims very seriously. It addressed each one of them. It explained in more detail than there was time for here the argument that I was just laying out. The appeals board decision also explained why the interpretation was consistent with other PBGC regulations relating to a similar five-year look back under the what's known as the phase-in rule in section 1322B of ERISA. Just very briefly on claim two, I'll rely primarily on our briefs relating to that, but let me just note that the pilots try to make it sound as though there was some change, some mandatory law that required this increase in benefits. That's simply not the case. The provision in question is section 415B of the Internal Revenue Code, which places a cap on the maximum benefit that a participant can receive from a pension plan. It's essentially a limit on tax benefits from pension plans. So it's just not correct to say, that cap is increased with cost of living adjustments. So when the cap goes up, pension plans are permitted to increase benefits accordingly, but they're not required to. So it's not a mandatory change, and therefore the Redig case, which the pilots cite in their brief, is just inapposite to that. Claim 10 seeks to overturn PBGC's longstanding interpretation of what it means to guarantee a benefit. We believe that we interpret the provision to mean what the word guarantee normally means. If no matter what happens to the pension plan, even if there are no assets whatsoever, PBGC is there to step in. We guarantee a minimum benefit for all participants. The pilots would turn that on its head and say, no, it's not a minimum guarantee of a benefit. It's a minimum requirement of expenditure by PBGC, that PBGC must spend at least this minimum amount on each participant up to the full plan benefit. That's just not consistent with the meaning of guarantee. It's also flatly contrary to 29 U.S.C. 1341C3B. That provision says that when a plan has enough assets to pay all the guaranteed benefits, but not enough to pay all the plan benefits, then the plan administrator is to close out the plan in the private sector and just distribute the assets without any payment from PBGC. If the pilot's theory were correct, then that provision couldn't be. The two just cannot be squared. Finally, just in the few seconds I have remaining, on the balance of harms and the public interest, I would like to note that this court recognized in the Bechtel case more than 20 years ago that PBGC has a duty to recoup overpayments. We have to be concerned about not just the participants in this pension plan, but all the participants in thousands of pension plans that we insure. In sum, the pilots have not met their burden of showing the factors necessary for preliminary injunction, and we urge this court to affirm the district court.
Can I ask one question? Did anything change after this court granted the injunction pending appeal in terms of what was happening?
Well, PBGC complied with it. We stopped recouping the overpayments from
They did stop recouping.
Did stop, yes.
So it's as if the preliminary injunction had been granted.
Yes, and we inform participants that if there's new information or a further ruling from this court, that we will let them know.
Okay.
All right, thank you. Does Mr. Shelley have any time left? All right, why don't you take a minute?
Thank you, Your Honor. My opponent mentions prior cases from the Supreme Court that he says showed the PBGC gets deference. None of them involved the PBGC as a trustee. And in fact, Judge Easterbrook in the matter of UAL Corp case even said that the PBGC acting as the government wouldn't probably get the deference it got there 15, 20 years ago, given the recent changes in Chevron deference. Going to Judge Brown's question earlier, deference to the interpretation of a regulation, even when the government's acting as a trustee, it even doesn't get deference to its interpretation of its own regulation. And for that proposition, we cited the Jack Arilla case from the Tenth Circuit. Finally, I'd just like to say the equities here on the PBGC side are quite weak. Their sole reason for existing is to protect individuals such as my clients, pensioners. They took 6 years to resolve the pilot's benefits, but can't even wait until the end of the litigation on judicial review to collect recoupment. They don't do it.
How long do you anticipate the litigation will last?
Well, we just had a motion to dismiss that was denied. Right. We haven't had our initial scheduling conference. No discovery's begun. I would suspect it's going to take a year or more in the district court, and I'm sure there will be inevitable appeals after that as well. So it may be 10 years from the termination of the plan to the time all appeals are done, that all the litigation associated with this plan will be done. And so we think the equities favor our clients, and we think the panel's earlier decision on the stay motion.
How much money per pilot is at stake per month?
Well, there are two different types of pilots.
Right, yeah.
The lump sum pilots, on average, I think the PBGC has put in the record, it's about $7,000 total dollars. But there are some people, such as Mr. Melliman, who we showed in one of our briefs, has $95,000 at issue. For the other pilots, I don't know the exact figure. It's in the hundreds of dollars. We're not talking about the thousands of dollars per month. But if you add it all up, you know, for years, it adds up to thousands of dollars, and many people living on fixed incomes. Thank you.
We'll take a short recess.